Greetings, Be Aware people. Welcome to Be Aware Nation, a corporation for evolution. We invite you to interact with us as we explore, develop, and synthesize awareness throughout layered living. We're evolutionizing the way people think, feel, and deal by merging medias into minds that matter. Being aware is a state to put your mind in. Join us as we consciously work to adapt the frameworks, models, and structures that make up all of our present-day operating systems and ownership models. We're here to fully explore the realm of where the ethereal becomes the material. Be Aware Nation is guided by the wisdom of the human spirit, utilizing the laws of science.
Ignition.
Greetings, Be Aware people, and thank you so much for joining us today. Today is a very special day because we have a very special guest, David Sarita, the co-founder of Voice Entertainment, which creates cutting-edge media in the fields of consciousness, spirituality, and science. And his newest film, which has just been released, is The Voice, which is an incredible science meets spirituality documentary movie. And David is an incredible person. He's got a long history as a director, a producer, filmmaker, photographer, author, public speaker, and he's got quite an interesting story to share with us, so we're very honored to have him here today.
Yes, it is. It's really quite an exciting time to really explore the realms of consciousness in the ways that David is. You know, here at Be Aware Nation, we're always looking at how to express the type of ethereal euphoria that we're all busy experiencing, and looking at the ways in which the boundaries and frameworks and sort of tenets that have been used to define that ethereal euphoria for all of us, as it breaks away and begins to lose its form and structure and hold on us in terms of the ways that we live our lives today, it's really interesting to find people that have lived their entire lives in pursuit of a greater understanding of how consciousness really begins to define our experiences from the moment we begin to exist. And so the nature of this particular internet radio network is really focused on the expanding states of awareness and how the realms of consciousness are being explored, and how we're all explorers on that pathway, sharing our various stories. And it's interesting for us because the basis of our work is really seeking structure within this new exploration and attempting to try to define a functional model to follow that we can base our own experiential activities on. And so looking for some plausible functionality within all of this consciousness exploration is really, I think, everybody's appetite has been whetted by so much of the discovery that has gone on in this field. And those that are capable of really articulating that discovery in a very salient and available manner have really grabbed our attentions. So things like The Secret that have come out and really showcased for people of the mainstream a particular way of looking at this expanding awareness and this expanding consciousness gives it so much plausibility and opens up so many ways for us to have a unique kind of conversation and discourse about that. And so we've really had an interesting opportunity to speak with David and about his own personal experiences, and clearly he is one of those chroniclers of consciousness that is really present in our midst, capable of articulating for us all a particular way of looking at this expanding field of consciousness and being able to use the various tools at his hand has articulated a story, I think, with this new movie that's going to excite all of us. So let's begin to open up the exploration with David. And from our viewpoint here at Be Aware Nation, as we know, we like to look through the prisms of possibilities that we identify through the UOS, GOS, and POS that make up the basis of this living system schema that we're attempting to craft from all of these components of awareness. And so David's going to have quite a bit to share with us today that's really going to be available as operating material for us all to use, for us to craft these living systems that of whatever substance, merit, and meaning means to each of us within our own interpretive field. And so we'd like to introduce you today to David Sirita.
David, are you there?
Yeah, I am, Barry and Sally. Thank you for having me on your show.
And Thank you for joining us.
I'd like to share with the audience that David's busy today taking time out within his current exploration at a consciousness celebration there in New Mexico.
Yeah. I'm at the Science and Consciousness Conference, the 10th International Conference in Santa Fe. And I'm actually interested in some of the speakers, perhaps interviewing them for a future film. I'm just kind of looking at the list here of who's here, and there's some really prominent researchers from Russia that I'm interested in. So I'm just kind of on a little bit of a road trip away from Sedona, about 6 hours away from Sedona.
Well, David, we've had a bit of an opportunity to have an introduction to each other and to you and your work and to your process, and I'd like to bring a little bit more of your own personal story, if you will, to bear for the listeners, because I think it's so important to establish, you know, the significance of your own process in your own personal developmental scale of arc, if you will, that has brought you to this place before we actually even introduce the movie, if you will.
Well, for me, this whole thing starts when, you know, I grew up in the 60s in Berkeley, and we moved, my family, my, you know, three brothers and I moved to Berkeley, California in 1964, and my dad, Lynn Sirita, was getting his PhD in psychology at the campus, and I remember being dragged around by my mom and my brothers during the tear gas riots and going to rock concerts with my dad, and it was a really amazing time to be a little kid in the middle of all that.
And are you able to understand that you were literally at the center of activity?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we lived, you know, just off the campus, you know, so it was in our backyard.
Oh, my goodness.
And literally at your dinner table if your father was a member of the campus.
Yeah, and he was getting his PhD in, he wrote his thesis on the healing and superlearning effects of deep relaxation and meditation. And they ended up finding out, you know, after conducting numerous experiments, that meditation and super deep relaxation could improve one's ability to learn, gain information, and also to heal. And so those were studies being done. And he, you know, eventually got involved in gurus, and my mom divorced him because the 60s were just too crazy for her Catholic background, and she married a military man whom raised me and my brothers, and then she divorced him in 1972, and all of a sudden I went from this super strict military science teacher of a father to my real father, who had long hair and a beard and was, you know, studying with gurus from India, and my brothers and I were just shocked. It's like, oh my God, what is all this stuff?
What a transition.
That's really quite a leap.
Yeah, and then, you know, slowly, it took a long time. It's not like we wanted to learn how to meditate, and he was telling us about masters, and I eventually went to meet my first guru from India with him, Baba Haridas, who's actually still alive. He lives in the mountains of Santa Cruz and teaches at the Mount Madonna Center. He's probably in his, you know, late 70s, early 80s now. And I started having experiences around this master that I just couldn't explain. I had no reason to really believe in any of this stuff. And in the middle of the night, I had this experience. I was sleeping in my tent near the master's house, and my dad was somewhere else. And, you know, I was about 13, 14 years old. So I was fine on my own, but I started to get this paralysis. I mean, it wasn't like sleep paralysis, because I was fully awake. This energy was crawling up my legs, and then it went into my spine. It was paralyzing me. And it had this feeling of strangulation. And it was quite terrifying, but I don't even know why, but at that age, I had no fear. I just said, relax, let this thing do to you what it wants to do. Like, so I let go, and my arms became paralyzed, and even with all my might, I couldn't move them. And then when it got into my neck, it got quite scary because I felt like I was being choked.
Huh.
And, you know what I said? You know, like someone would think, oh, this is demonic possession, but I just said, just relax, let it choke you. And I can't even believe at 14 years old I did that. And when I did that, all of a sudden, I was in this other place, this pearly, black, velvety space with this kind of light sapphire color to it. And then instantly, three beings of shining light appeared in front of me, blazing with blue light. I saw a half-human, half-monkey person who was so beautiful, and his crown was adorned with jewels, and his third eye was a jewel, but it was alive. I could see this thing wasn't a rock. It was alive. And the light was so bright, I was in terror. I saw myself fallen on the ground, like unable to stand up. And next to him was this unbelievably beautiful woman whose crown was adorned with jewels, and her third eye was alive. It was a jewel, but it was alive. And then this man was with her, and all three of them were just utterly gorgeous. And I looked at them with such clarity, their faces, their eyes. And I had never seen any pictures in my life, I mean, coming from a military family background, of who I was looking at. And the next morning, I told the guru in front of the session, you know, there must have been 200 people there at the retreat, that I described that I saw this monkey man and these two, you know, man and this woman who were blazing with blue light. And he laughed and he said, oh, that was Hanuman, the Hindu, you know, sacred deity who was always seen with Rama and Sita. Which are manifestations of Krishna and Radha in as supreme, absolutely supreme deities in Hinduism. And I had no idea why this happened to me. I had just started yoga and meditation. And when I had that experience, I knew this stuff was real. I knew that there's no way I could ignore what happened to me. And it took many years after that. Even after that, when I, you know, was in high school, I suffered emotionally tremendously from the loss of my mother. I cried every day for about 2 years. I always found time to cry because I missed her so much, and my heart got so tense, and my dad found these lumps in my chest, and he used to push on them and make me cry and scream the pain out. And eventually I got more and more depressed because my heart chakra was just shut down. I didn't want to bond with my dad. And my brothers didn't want to either, and I became this angry teenager rebel who was breaking windows and doing horrible things in my high school classes. And by the time I was about 16, 17, I was meditating every single day. I started to meditate a lot, and the meditation was slowly allowing me to relax, and the blood was flowing into my heart again. And I started to bond with my dad, and the depression slowly went away over the years. And then my dad, when I was about 20 years old, I think this is in like 1979-ish, somewhere in there, or early 80s, I attended a Buddhist retreat that my dad was teaching, where you sat in meditation for 12 hours a day in the Buddha posture. You would sit for an hour, get up and walk in slow motion, then sit for an hour, get up, walk in slow motion, then have tea, have a nap, and then start again, and then have, and you did this all day.
Mm.
And I'm telling you, I climbed mountains, I'm an extreme skier, I skydived, I planted trees for 22 years in the mountains of British Columbia, I planted way over a million trees in my life, and there's nothing harder than holding this posture. Doing nothing is the hardest thing to do. And even if you sit in a chair, I don't care what it is, if you don't move, there's no way to escape it. What starts to happen is even people who try to meditate in chairs, you do that 12 hours a day, your body starts to go into spasms. It what happens is the muscles tighten up, and then they let go, they tighten up, and then they let go throughout the day. And you just face this apparent boredom and opaqueness of the mind, and you're doing this Buddhist technique. And on the second day, my body was in so much pain from sitting, and more pain than riding my bicycle for 35 miles, which I used to do a lot of times. And I was shaking, and then all of a sudden this explosion of ecstasy started right in my belly, and it was blinding ecstasy. It was so bright. I started laughing like the laughing Buddha. And you're supposed to be quiet in the meditation hall, and people are looking at me, and I'm like, oh, you got to get out of here. I mean, there's no way you can contain this. So I just left. I walked in the park and just roared with laughter and looked at the trees and the grass and the sky, and I wasn't my body anymore. I could barely feel the presence of my footsteps. It was like I was this floating field. I mean, I could feel my footsteps, but it's like I was in this field. And I could hear the sounds of every plant, every blade of grass, every rock were all making these sounds blending into this symphonic hum. Mm-hmm. And it was very noticeable. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like my ears were hearing it. It was like the field was hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came upon these three weeping willow trees, and I think of the Buddha's love for sitting under the Bodhi tree. And mm-hmm. when the wind would blow through the trees, I would laugh because it was tickling me. It was like it was... I could feel it like it was touching my own hair. And I said, how is this possible? I'm really feeling this tree, and the tree looked like ecstasy was raining on the tree. I felt that ecstasy. That ecstasy was touching the tree, the grass, everything, and it was so bright and so peacefully sustained, not like a kind of a rush high you get if you climb a mountain and you go, wow, and you release this burst of adrenaline. It's nothing like that. It's so much better than that. And the ecstasy didn't stop, and that was one of the things that astounded me as I did this experiment. Like, you know, let's see how fragile this experience is. Let's try to, like, think negative thoughts or make this thing go away. And it didn't matter what I did. I was in ecstasy.
Hmm.
And then I looked up at the sun, and I went, oh, my God, the sun is making this cosmic sound. It's humming. And it has this really high-pitched ring and this really deep, low hum. And everything was just like, you know, Alice in Wonderland. It was unbelievably poetic. Everywhere I turned, it didn't matter what I put my attention to. I looked at the sun for a long time, and then I went back to the meditation hall, and all the meditators were coming out for their walking lesson, the slow-motion walking. And I looked at this surfer guy, a friend of my brother's, who was doing the retreat. And every time we looked at each other, it was like a big flash of ecstasy. Like even, it's like it magnified.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he looked at me, he started laughing. You know, it's almost mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, you think of, you know, some two guys doing pot and they're laughing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is way better than anything like that. It was so clear. The ecstasy flashes were so bright. And then we would look down because the teacher says never look at other people. And I was like trying to follow the rules. But I kept wanting to experience his spirit. And I would look at him, and we both would get the hit. It was just like light waves hitting both of us. And then I did the walking. I remained in this state for a long time, and I went back to sitting. And that day was the day that I fell in love with trees, and I decided I want to be a tree planter.
Oh,
and for me, the decision to not become an academic like my father and my mother's an attorney and my uncle's a superior court judge and in Ottawa and Canada, I didn't want to follow any family traditions. I wanted to go deeper into this quest for enlightenment. And I wondered why the state of consciousness eventually left me and how I would attain permanent realization. And of course, as my years evolved, more and more amazing spiritual experiences happened. I meditated every single day. I've done hundreds of rebirthings, breath therapy, emotional release therapies, hypnotherapies, sitting meditation, insight meditation, mantra. I've done every meditation and form of yoga and asana there is. And I just kept practicing and practicing. And eventually I got to the point where I had two more super experiences that are so, like I said on a conversation before, it sounds like a science fiction movie. It sounds like when I tell people these stories, like, you're not going to believe this when I tell you. you know,
and truly, David, I think part of the difficulty that most people have in non-believing is that so much of the structural basis of our everyday lives is in no way, shape, or form comprised of allowing for the kinds of things that you want to say to describe the experience. And that is so much of a hurdle we have, and I don't know whether that was the original basis for why so many dogmas and doctrines and teachings really suggested at the core to not speak of it for fear of changing it and altering the scope of its magnanimity. It's really something, though, to share what you're saying and understand viscerally what that feeling is as the tree is laughing.
Exactly. The tree is laughing. I mean, when Buddha approached the Bodhi tree in India, and I actually went to India to go to the very, you know, tree, well, actually the offspring of the tree that he sat under. And the monks there, they have these footprints that are like a sacred footprint that mark the spot when Buddha approached the Bodhi tree. He stopped and he gazed at it. And some monks say he stood day and night for 3 days without moving a millimeter. For 3 days in utter awe of the tree before he approaches it to attain his full nirvana. And other monks say it was as long as 3 months that his body was unmoving. And to really appreciate what nirvana is and what the full extent of what is true and authentic enlightenment, that is, before I describe the full vision, is what inspired me to make the film The Voice, because not only did I find that science was verifying the super fields of consciousness, which I have in literature discovered there are 9 ascending rings or fields of consciousness that go way beyond the body into the supercosmic proportions. And that when I was in India, I found this very sacred Tibetan scripture called the Lankavatara Sutra, which is considered paramount to Tibetan Buddhism, where Buddha describes that over 400 lifetimes, he perfects 6 samadhis, or super fields of consciousness. And 1 through 6 are called the samadhis, and the samadhis are not permanent, which would explain why you can have this super meditation experience and go into a samadhi and then it goes away. That's what I mean by not permanent. Mm-hmm. And that was shocking for me because I always wanted to find out, you know, how to stay in that state longer. And it's really amazing what I ended up finding out. But in 1996, December 22nd and 23rd, this is way before I went to India, before I complete the kind of vision, I, you know, practice is 7 years into a daily practice. So when I describe this story, it will sound like a science fiction movie to a lot of the listeners, but you have to understand, I was meditating 3, 4, and sometimes 6 hours every single day for 7 years. And I was very intense about this, and I was planting trees for 7 years at that point in my life. I had probably planted close to, you know, easily 300,000 or 400,000 trees in my life at that point. So I was doing the Dharma, I was doing the work, I was being an ecologist, and I wasn't seeking financial gain and riches in my life. I just wanted God. I wanted enlightenment. And if you're really passionate about this stuff and you really do these practices, regardless of your religion, it will happen to you too. I mean, this is everybody's potential. But what happened on December 22nd at 4:15 in the afternoon, which is the time of day that I was born, but I was born in the summer, I felt like I was dying. I got that same paralysis that I got when I was a little kid at the yoga retreat. I started shaking at the knees, and I was like, you know, I'm not tired. What's wrong? There was this energy coming over me that was cracking me. I felt like there was a fissure, like an earthquake had severed me from the inside. And I just had to lie down. I was really cracking up, as if, you know, literally coming apart at the seams. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I lie down, I was in this crystal clear vision, and I see these 2 women in white praying over the body of a man who looks like he's absolutely dead. His face is pale as a ghost. He's in the poorest of the poorest house. And his vision happened instantly. And I saw these women praying over his body who had long, straight, really dark hair. And all of a sudden, the old man got up and he looked at me, and I went, oh, my God, I thought you were dead. And he said, do you want to see an angel? And I mean, in this point in my life, I'm Buddhist, hardcore Buddhist. I mean, an angel wasn't even in my vocabulary, in my own approach to God. And the second I said yes, thunderously deafening sounds of angels and this fluttering wind started strobing, pulsing, like, I mean, louder than the most beautiful voices of angels. I mean, it was so beautiful, it would make Beethoven seem boring. literally. And there was this light. It was dissolving the vision of the house that the old man was in. And I saw that the light was killing me. It was what was making me shake and crack apart at the seams and in the fissure. And I just surrendered into it. I collapsed on the floor in the vision, and I saw these two women fall on the floor and become paralyzed like I did, losing control of our own wills. And I looked up and I thought, I mean, there was no voice, no ecstasy, just pure fear of God. I mean, talk about the fear of God. It was so obvious that these angels' voices were the voices of God. And they were so beautiful, but I was in utter terror. And then eventually, the moment I just relaxed, and I said, obviously this isn't evil. These are the voices of the angels. And I knew about the fear of God, and you know, from the old, you know, scriptures. And when I surrendered and didn't fight it, an explosion of ecstasy, like, I mean, literally the size of a supernova. It was huge. It was massive. Started in my belly. And it was so, the ecstasy levels were, I mean, a million times greater than the best, you know, sexual experience or the best bliss and love I've ever experienced on earth. A million times. And all of a sudden, my body became so bright, and it went above the house, through the roof, above the city of Vancouver, above the rain clouds and into the galaxy. And I was zooming at superluminal, which means many times faster than the speed of light. And I was zooming towards what appeared to be the center of the galaxy. And this voice told me in the light that this first heaven that I'm in, and I look down at my body, glowing with light, it's totally human. There's not an ounce of suffering. I'm seeing and hearing the music of the angels through every atom in my body. If I close my eyes, I can see. If I pointed my finger, I can look through my fingertip at distant star systems. And the voice said, there are millions of paradise planets in this heaven. And then I started approaching this membrane. It was like hundreds of light years in size in front of me. It was like a glass bubble. And as I approached it, the ecstasy levels became torrential for this particular body that I became. And I was being crushed with so much love and ecstasy and peace and power and beauty. I said, God, please stop this stuff. This was beyond my abilities. I couldn't handle the ecstasy levels. And yet I went through the membrane and I went into the second heaven. And the ecstasy and the love and the power and the beauty multiplied a millionfold over that. So it's a million times a million. But this new body that I possessed in the second could sustain it. It actually could sustain it. And to make a longer story short, I went all the way. When I got past the third, the human form completely disappeared. I became fields of light that were light years across. I mean, I was this massive orb of light moving towards the center of the galaxy. And the ecstasy levels are just, it's inconceivable. I doubted all gurus at the third level. I said, you wouldn't know where your foot is. Hence Buddha standing and looking at the Bodhi tree and not being able to move for 3 days or 3 months. You wouldn't even know where your hand is. Mm-hmm. These fields are so massive that there's no possible way you could move it, even a fingertip in this state. And I went into the fourth, and it multiplied another million times. In the fifth, another million times. And now remember, Buddha is telling us in the Lankavatara Sutra that 1 through 6 are impermanent. Nirvana begins at the seventh. There are actually 3 nirvanas. I go all the way to the sixth, to the far end of the sixth. I come to the membrane of the seventh. And I actually got as far as inside the membrane of the seventh. I knew that if I crossed, I just felt that that was it. You could never come back. And the desire to come back and tell others and that the kingdom of heaven is real and you really got to do this, it's the most far out thing. Meditation is the greatest thing in the world. I wanted to come back. I didn't want to cross. Mm-hmm. And it was also, it felt like there was something that was going to happen at the seventh that was going to blow all of the previous 6 way out of the water. I mean, not just a million times. Something really heavy happens at that level. And I didn't even know about the Lankavatara Sutra. I mean, I'm 27 years old. I haven't read the Lankavatara Sutra. Nobody can tell me where I was in the universe. And I just turned back. And I woke up in my body, and my spinal column was buzzing like an electric vibrator. It was like this in my bed. And it's like someone turned out the light of 100 billion suns, and I was just this normal human again. And the next day at 4:15 in the afternoon happened again. I went through all six, came to the edge of the seventh, and turned back. So that gave me this whole new vision of what every human being deserves. I really felt that when I was in these fields, that this is our birthright. We don't really deserve suffering. What we deserve is this. This is what we all actually deserve. But somehow coming into the, you know, coming back out of the state, they were not permanent. And I was so mystified. For years I went to meetings at the International Association for Near-Death Studies for about 5 years. I attended the monthly meetings. I wanted to know where I was. I went to India and I met with Tibetan Rinpoches that were quite young, and none of them had ever heard of this experience. And then I picked up the Lankavatara Sutra of the Buddha, and I went, oh my God, this is the answer. And this would explain why Buddha couldn't move a foot when he was approaching, because when he approaches the Bodhi tree, he's up to the level of the sixth samadhi, which is as far as I went. But when he sits under the Bodhi tree for 24 hours and attains the seventh, you don't go back. After the seventh, you don't go back to the normal consciousness. And Buddha does that, and then what the Buddha does, and this is written in the Dhammapada, is he goes from nirvana down the six samadhis into meditation, down to concentration, then all the way back up again, back down, back up, until he can scientifically build a teaching, a vehicle, what the Buddhists call vehicles, that can be repeated multiple times, just like when you turn the key on your car, the car starts because somebody has perfected this mantra, this repetition, this system.
The concept of reliable functionality.
Over and over again. What's that?
The concept of reliable functionality.
Exactly. And that's what Buddhism is. It is a reliable, repeatable model that if you do this practice, you're going to get this result. And then his wife, Yasodhara, whom he left, very few people know this story. It's actually in the Dhammapada, but the Buddhists don't talk about it much. Yasodhara, when Buddha went into the forest for I think it was 6 years to search for nirvana, and when he finally attains nirvana, the first thing he does, he goes back to the palace because he was a prince Siddhartha, and Princess Yasodhara had shaved her head, got rid of all of her jewelry, and was meditating every single day. And as soon as she sees the Buddha, who is now in nirvana, their nirvana field permanently realized, so you really understand what that nirvana really is now. And she falls at his feet like Mary Magdalene does to Jesus and cries a river of tears, wipes his feet with her tears, and then within a very short time, she attains nirvana too. So she is his equal. Yasodhara is Buddha's equal. She has crossed the seventh veil, and eventually Buddha says in the sutra, you attain the eighth and the ninth, which are just unimaginable. At this point of our evolution, Jesus told me in these super fields of light, which was December 22nd and 23rd, that we become creator gods and goddesses. We literally get so powerful. It's like we're these little seeds right now, suffering and, you know, eating food and the things that human beings pursue and money and all these things. We eventually become creator gods and goddesses at that level. We create galaxies. We create star systems for fun at that level. That's how powerful every one of us will eventually become. That's why there's hundreds of millions of galaxies in the universe, because eventually we become likened unto God. We become super creators. So that's where we're all headed. And at this level of freedom, when you have the freedom to dematerialize your body and travel anywhere you want in the universe and live in multiple paradises and have paradise bodies that live for millions of years, the idea of, you know, what are you going to do in life? You know, this was my decision. Are you going to become a tree planter and make very little money and not even own a house and try to find how to gain access to the universe, or are you going to try to, you know, go for money right away and attain wealth? And for me, it was just very clear at a very young age that, you know, that's not where it's at. You see all these people who are miserable, and you see, why did the Buddha renounce his wealth to go seek nirvana? Why did St. Francis renounce his wealth, a rich son of an architect in Italy, to go seek enlightenment? Why do these people do this? And why are so many celebrities so bored out of their minds? They all get messed up. You see all these stories of celebrities that are, you know, ODing on drugs and doing too many drugs, and the stories of, you know, of these people. It just shows that once you have the power and the wealth to have any fantasy fulfilled you want, it eventually bores you. But if you fall in love, like Buddha and Yasodhara did, like Jesus and Mary Magdalene did, like Krishna and Radha did, like Rama and Sita did, like all the great divine pairs and Padmasambhava the Buddha and Yishishagyal, you can go into this whole other dimension of being together as couples. And that's ultimately what I decided I wanted. I didn't want to be a lone monk. I wanted to be like the super divine couples. Like I saw, my first super experience was Krishna and Radha as Rama and Sita and Hanuman. And I eventually found my soulmate, Crystal. And it's just a whole other thing when you're meditating every day and you go into ecstasy and you have someone to dance and share it with. It's just so special.
That must be quite a story all of its own, after a journey and a story like that, David, to recognize such a poignancy to your own personal process and recognize that in truly fulfilling it the way your own spirit informs you, that coupling, that finding the kind of unification of your spirit with that other, brings a fullness and a quality to the experience, unlike anything else available. And again, another one of those ways in which here in this, way we live as humans, in the primitive ways in which we express ourselves, so much of, that whole interpretation of what's possible together, really isn't brought into the light of day for public discourse and exampling and modeling the way.
Not at all. I'm glad you brought that up, because even in the New Age and spiritual communities, in the super yoga personalities that are very famous all over Hollywood now, most of these people, like Rodney Yee, who's a big yoga star, and he said he hasn't even begun his path of meditation. He's still doing the asanas. And actually, very few people know the true vision of what authentic enlightenment is, and that's what inspired me to make The Voice. I wanted to show the scientific evidence that atoms have, or subatomic particles have, are particles and fields at the same time. And those little fields eventually culminate into the auras of trees. We have a profound scientific plant researcher in the film, The Voice, named Mylise, who's verifying the consciousness of plants through technology. Then you get into a new camera developed by a Russian physicist who's here in Santa Fe lecturing tomorrow, Konstantin Korotkov, who developed the world's first 3D human aura imaging camera and software. We feature this in the film. And the discovery of biophotons by a German scientist, Fritz Albert Popp, who proved...
I'm sorry, David. Don't. You're speaking about some very... fundamentally important things for all of us to know about, and I'd like to understand them. A bio what? Photon?
Yeah, in 1976, which of course is a long time ago now, Fritz Albert Popp, a German scientist who's still researching today in Germany, discovered that every living organism, from single cells to, you know, to plants, to humans, to animals, mammals, are all emitting light waves, which biophoton means organic, alive light waves. That's essentially how it translates, because photons are particles of light.
Mm-hmm.
So that everything is emitting light, and then he proved quite recently, they've actually scientifically proven this, which is different than just theorizing it, that plants and organisms can send information back and forth between one another through the field, right, which is the auric field.
Which is the expression of the light field itself, is information
right.
itself passing back and forth.
Right, and that starts to get into your model where you see these three major arcana of, you have the organism, which is like the particle, and then you have, you know, you have the information and the field, and how the, when, what happens is, when we go into these, when the aura, and if you see, for example, the paintings of Buddha and Christ and Mary, the Virgin Mary Magdalene, and the saints of all religions, you see this kind of pie plate, glowing gold kind of sphere around the head region. Now, imagine that you just take away the image of the saint and God, and you just have the field. Try to visualize that.
Just,
in fact,
just
the God
light
of the Old Testament warns humanity to never bow down or make graven, which means serious, images of God, because God knows that we would get so caught up in our egotistical images and when we of God, and we would see that they were different. We would go to war with each other thinking we had different gods. But if you strip the images away, the serious images away, it's not that God of the Old Testament is saying don't have any images, don't have any graven images, which means serious. So if you just saw the field, the aura around Christ and Mary Magdalene, and you saw that that field was expanding like rings into the cosmos, and eventually those auras are merging with fields that are the size of galaxies and then universes, because there are multiple universes. That is the true vision of what God consciousness really is. It's the field. Einstein said, there is no room in this new physics for both matter and the field. So the field is the only reality. And the field originally seemed so hard to detect because we only see physical objects, particles. The field is like this invisible thing that you can't really verify. But the more physicists started evolving, they started to find more and more evidence of the field, and eventually Einstein gets so mystified by how the fields are functioning and exchanging information with particles that he eventually goes on to say that anyone who becomes serious in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that there is a spirit vastly superior to man in the universe. For Einstein to say that, as a Jew and as a scientist, who eventually, in a lot of ways, becomes agnostic, is remarkable. He is saying that we have verified an intelligent field in the universe. And what the experiments were that he discovered were called spooky action at a distance. Einstein found that not only were particles communicating with each other at a distance faster than the speed of light, instantaneously, but that living systems could do the same thing, not just particles. They did tests like with a mother and a baby rabbit, and they separate the mother and the baby rabbit by 1,000 miles. They hook their brains up to EEGs. They pinprick the baby rabbit, and the mother responds instantaneously. Not if the two rabbits were talking on cell phones, then they would actually get stuck with the limitation of the speed of light, meaning a cell phone. They would be limited to the speed of light, but this was happening instantaneously, and Einstein got so spooked by it because his general field of relativity couldn't explain it. And that is where this all begins, where science starts to verify the field. And for me, that was so exciting to see that, you know, nobody had put these together, and then I found that research was being done at Princeton, Einstein's university, a project called the Global Consciousness Project, headed by Director Roger Nelson, whom discovers that the Earth, Gaia, has a actual auric field that they're now measuring and verifying the existence of. And that is in the film The Voice.
And so before we're running out of time here, David, but I want people to have a real good, solid sense of what the movie is and what it's comprised of, what the purpose behind it is, and how you carried it off and how you're delivering it so that people can be exposed to it. So tell us a bit about that, if you will, in an overview.
Well, I started to get kind of frustrated that nobody was, and there were all these films about the genocide of the Tibetans and the crimes against religions and, you know, the Holocaust. of the Jews and, you know, all the Christian crusades, but there was no film that really painted a true vision of what is total enlightenment and what science is discovering and verifying in respect to what is true and authentic enlightenment. And so that inspired me to make The Voice, and I ended up finding amazing scientists that we interviewed, people like, you know, Roger Nelson at Princeton, Gary Schwartz, who's a Harvard Yale professor, is in the film. He heads the most advanced consciousness studies lab in the nation at the University of Arizona at Tucson, and he is just brilliant in the film. Stanley Krippner, PhD, who is one of the world's most renowned dream psychologists. My father, Dr. Lynn Sarita, is in the film. Robert Thurman, who is a professor of Far Eastern Studies and whom Time Magazine called one of the 27 most influential people in the world in 1997. So we have a lot of big names, but then we have these people that nobody's ever heard of, who are having profound mystical experiences, artists even, and they're sharing their experiences, and then interwoven between the serious science and the new aura camera that can see your aura in 3D, we're educating people about the auras of subatomic particles, how they communicate with each other, and ultimately how those fields interrelate with the nine greater rings of enlightenment. And then the ultimate question is, as all human beings suffer, experience death and limitation, what if information, consciousness, is the authority over matter? It can tell it what to do, and we actually show several experiments in this three-hour journey, this, you know, three-hour miniseries, The Voice. What is this set of instructions at a very, very deep subconscious level that we're giving ourselves that causes our suffering, causes our boredom, causes us to not be in ecstasy? And not only ecstasy, it's very important to realize that, you know, once you stabilize in the super ecstasy of these fields, then it's the gnosis, the knowledge, the answer to anything you can imagine. The answer to how to build a spaceship and fly across the universe is in the field. The answer to how the universe is working is in the field. The answer to the cure for AIDS and cancer is in the field. You just have to know how to create a dialogue with it. Because the fields are all known.
Just for people's own purposes, so they're following along and understanding and looking forward to being exposed to the film and the miniseries, clearly, when you're speaking to the concept of the field, an awful lot of people have a difficult time really wrapping their arms and expanding minds even around this concept that the field is the basis of being, if you will. And when you speak to the use of the field as a resource that people are going to be using as they become more aware of its existence and their connection to their own personal experience as a result of this field, does the making of this miniseries, is it about explaining that fundamentally the exploration of consciousness and therefore understanding the field's influence over the realm of consciousness? Is this all in and of itself an extension, an expansion of brain science?
Well, yes. And if you see the brain as a particle,
well, just trying to connect the personal sense of self, the person in their being, in their physical body, in their physical being, having this experience of consciousness and wanting more consciousness, and how to leverage their state of being to access more consciousness, takes more understanding of how that consciousness gets imparted is a part of our experience. So I just am saying that the way in which, as you said, as physics evolved, clearly physics and the sciences, as they have evolved, they continue to tell a broader and brighter and more meaningful picture. And so clearly, as people go forward, opening their own minds to how brain science itself okay, yes, there's an organism inside our body. Is that organism inside our body the connective tissue, if you will, to these ethereal mind-expanding experiences? Is
the
there
brain
a physical material link?
It is. It's like an indexer. It's like you need a particle and a wave in physics could never be separated. You can't separate the particle from the wave. It's called the ultimate conundrum for a quantum physicist. Is a particle or is it a wave? It's actually both. So it's both a field and a particle. And in the film, The Voice, not only do we share the experiences of many different people who are having expanded states of consciousness, but we also do these experiments before and after different types of meditation to show you with real evidence how much bigger the auric field gets before and after meditation using the GDV 3D aura imaging camera and software. So we can start to see, but near the end of the film, we get into the master code, the cause of why our field is so small, why it's only a few feet beyond the human body, why it's a dimly lit bulb, and that is we start getting into the polarity matrix and identifying the polarity matrix, the limitations, and ultimately revealing why the polarity matrix causes suffering, disease, death, and war. And ultimately, even an even deeper question is why matter can't move faster than the speed of light. And the attainment of singularity, non-dualism, which is extant in all the major religions of the world. It's a very, very deep subject, which we start to explore at the end. Because, you know, we know in the movie, like, What the Bleep Do We Know? And Betsy Chossy, who is co-director, producer of The Bleep, is our distributor for The Voice with us, and also the movie Water right now. And there was so much evidence in that film that we are affecting and co-creating our reality. But a deeper question is, our reality is that most of us suffer. Most of us are not in bliss and ecstasy all day long, and most of us don't have access to the kind of knowledge that Einstein and Tesla and Faraday and, you know, and you know, all these great medical scientists are discovering. They don't know how to tap into that kind of knowledge. And ultimately, what we find is that there is an actual set of instructions that we're giving our subconscious minds, which is called the polarity matrix field, that causes our field to be very, very small. And that is really an enormous subject. It's actually a massive subject that we start to come into at the end of the film, which will reveal itself and make itself quite clear, but open the doorway for the next film. You know, where do we want to go next? And I think that's the next step. We can prove scientifically that we're affecting reality, but the reality is we suffer. And we feel bored. We feel we need entertainment because we're so bored. So, and we have a lack of knowledge. We don't know the cure for AIDS. We don't know how to fly to another star system. So where do we get that knowledge? And the answers to those questions are in the fields. So the question is, how do you expand your consciousness into the field? And that becomes very clear by the end of the movie.
Thank you, David. That's a very, very salient explanation and clear analysis. Really, it's for, and as you've stated, to take us all through the journey of discovery at that level, only to leave us at the precipice of such grandeur, hungry for more, is an excellent filmmaking technique and an excellent marketing technique as well. But in the meantime, how in the world are people supposed to see it?
Well, you can go to voiceentertainment.net/store and order the DVD, or go to bleepstore.com. You can get it at the, you know, What the Bleep Store online.
At the What the Bleep Store on the internet. We also actually have a link on our info, link on our page here at the BBS Radio, and we'll put one on our BOR Nation site as well, David. Is it going to have any kind of public airing?
Well, there's going to be private screenings at spiritual bookstores and hopefully, you know, small theaters. The two-hour version, the three-hour extended version is the DVD version. And you can go to any bookstore right now and ask them to get it from Newly for one of the major catalog orders. It's probably going to be in every spiritual bookstore in America by the end of the month, by the end of April. So
Excellent.
You can even go to your store.
And so clearly, when
that.
They go to that website, they have an opportunity to buy the entire three-hour DVD?
Yeah, they do. And if you go to Blockbuster, you can just, you know, say, can you get The Voice? And
totally.
That will help it get into the rentals, and Netflix should have it. So you can rent it. But I had this woman who is won 3 Emmy Awards as a news producer, and her name is Allison. I'm not going to give out her last name. She's a news anchor. She watched it 6 times and she's now trying to get me on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And the point is, seeing it once is not enough. I mean, it's like you have to go through this several times because there's so much information. There's so many brilliant people in the film who have shown so much knowledge to share. If you really want to get it, it has to become like a mantra, a repetition. You watch it, you know, I mean, my friend Allison watched it 6 times in a row. I mean, that's crazy. Really, really, she just loves the film so much. But now, you know, people are on our website calling it Beyond Down the Rabbit Hole, The Next Step. And the reviews are almost consistently uniform that everybody loves this film. And for me, after years of making films, you know, I made Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, Evidence, The Case for NASA UFOs, From Here to Andromeda, and I've made some other, quite a few short films that I put on YouTube about ecology things, tree planting and electric cars and such. The Voice, I think, is going to go the furthest of anything I've ever done. And it's because I really think there is a lack of the total understanding of what is the true human potential, what is our birthright, and what does real enlightenment look like all the way to the seventh and beyond.
Well,
and
David, we are so thrilled that you will go through that membrane at some point, but you've come back twice to give us this gift and share this wealth of knowledge that you have so that we can all have access to such incredible knowledge that we all yearn for. Our time is up. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating, and I'm sure The Voice is going to carry us all forward, so congratulations.
Thank you very much, Terry, and thank you very much to everybody here for having an opportunity to listen to The Voice, and hopefully get yourselves over to that website and find out what the next step in consciousness is. Thank you very much to the Be Aware people out there, and see you next week. And until then, see you in the ether.
See you in the ether. Bye-bye. Thank you for joining us, Be Aware people, here at Be Aware Nation, where being aware is a state to put your mind in. So come visit us at BeAwareNation.com. Until we can continue our conversation next Sunday at 5 p.m. here on BBS Radio Channel 1, where we'll look forward to finding out what you're doing to merge medias into your mind in a way that matters. Remember, life affirms what you believe, so don't believe everything you think. Into it, your way home. See you in the ether.